This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today on the program, immigrants use art to connect their stories to the locals. The tricky role first responders play in deciding the fate of mentally ill youth, and a permaculture primer from the frozen North Country. But first, you're no doubt familiar with the online retailers Amazon, eBay, and Craigslist for selling and swapping goods and services. We recently read about a site that caters to the shadier side of e-commerce. The Silk Road is an online black market where nearly anything can be bought and sold, from Afghani hashish to assault weapons to prescription meds, assuming you can find your way there. Freelance magazine journalist Sabrina Erdely wrote about the Silk Road for Rolling Stone magazine, where she is contributing editor. She's on the line with us to tell us what she found on the darker side of e-commerce. Sabrina, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
How hard is it to get to the Silk Road? I understand you needed the help of a hacker just to connect.
Right, I did. I know a hacker who acted as kind of a Virgil in guiding me into this whole underworld. Getting to Silk Road takes a little bit of technical know-how and patience, because it isn't a website you can access through your regular browser. Even if you have the web address, which is very forgettable, it's basically just a string of letters and numbers, if you plug that URL into your regular browser, like Internet Explorer or Firefox, it'll say the site can't be found. The only way to access it is with a software called Tor, that's spelled T-O-R, which is an anonymizing software. It lets users use the web without being traced. This is a program that was not intended as a way to allow people to buy, you know, cocaine and M16s online. It was actually developed so that if you live in a country with an oppressive government, you can post things online or access information online without fear of repercussions.
And that's where opportunism sets in. So what does it look like once you get there to the Silk Road?
Well, once you get to the site, it's sort of hilariously cozy. It's true. The layout would be familiar to anyone who's ever shopped online, right down to the little shopping cart in the upper right-hand corner. And along the left side of the page, right where you'd expect it, you've got all the categories of things you can buy. And the site also has a feedback system, just like you'd find on Amazon or eBay, with ratings 1 through 5. So if you're curious about other buyers' experiences with a particular seller, you can just click on their comments. So the website isn't as polished looking as a professional legal marketplace, but anyone who's used Amazon or eBay would have no problem using Silk Road.
In fact, in your article, there's a little graphic from Silk Road Anonymous Marketplace, you know, drugs, 343 findings, you know, it lists ecstasy, psychedelics, opiates. It's really quite something. And then you can just add it to your cart. What are some of the things that are on sale on the Silk Road?
Oh, the things for sale, they run the gamut. There's every type of illegal drug you can imagine, first of all, and they break it down into categories to make it easier for you. You know, there's cannabis, ecstasy, dissociatives, opioids, stimulants, benzos, and then there's just a category called other, where you can find you know, prescription medications, injectable steroids, you know, cheap cartons of cigarettes. There's also a weapons section where you can get machine guns and ammunition. There's a pornography section, and there's a forgeries section, too. When I was on there, in the forgery section, you could get a fake driver's license, a doctor's prescription pad, and there was even a seller who was claiming to have a fully editable UCLA acceptance letter.
Wowie. How does the site not get busted by authorities or the DEA?
Well, sellers feel fairly comfortable openly selling these things on Silk Road because the identities of buyers and sellers are completely obscured thanks to the Tor software. Tracing illegal stuff online back to its source is always a challenge for law enforcement, but this is especially challenging for the DEA because of the anonymity of Tor. It hides people's IP addresses. And then there are additional precautions that people take so that they don't get caught. I mean, for one thing, the site encourages sellers to creatively disguise their shipments and to vacuum pack their drugs so that they don't give off, you know, a suspicious odor and raise the suspicions from the FedEx guy. Also, there's another level of anonymity through the payment system because Silk Road doesn't accept credit cards or PayPal or any form of payment that can be easily traced.
All right, so what do they do? How do people pay for goods?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because the site only accepts something called Bitcoin, which is a new virtual currency system. It's known as a peer-to-peer cash system, and it's generated by other computer users. And it was developed as an alternative currency to keep banks and governments out of the loop. And there are a number of anti-establishment philosophies at play behind the development of Bitcoin. But the use of Bitcoins to buy illegal drugs is yet another example of technology being used in ways where people may or may not really, have intended. Supposedly, Bitcoin transactions are completely anonymous. Although I spoke with a couple of Bitcoin's developers, and both of them insisted that a really determined detective could trace a purchase back to its source, because every Bitcoin transaction is broadcast over the internet in code. But even if that is the case, it does add another obstacle between you and law enforcement. So if someone's looking to make a purchase on Silk Road, first you have to go and change your money for some Bitcoins, which you can do just like you're changing your dollars for a foreign currency. You do it online. There are a small handful of websites that will change your currency for Bitcoins. And then you put the Bitcoins into your Silk Road account, and it's like the digital equivalent of walking in with a paper bag full of cash.
We're speaking with Sabrina Erderly. She wrote about the online black marketplace, The Silk Road, for Rolling Stone magazine, where she's a contributing editor. Well, so far, we're giving people quite a little primer in using this. I mean, are you afraid that reporting on it is going to draw more interest to this black market site?
Well, I mean, like the site says, when you log on, you use it at your own risk. I mean, I would not recommend anybody use it. And the site does warn you. You know, when I first got on there, there's this gigantic warning saying this is an experimental site and they can't guarantee your protection from law enforcement or from other users. That certainly made me hesitate before I clicked agree. But I did. All in the name of research. Didn't buy anything, of course.
An anonymous administrator told you via email that they are a bright and honest and cooperative community. I mean, there's a real sense of, I guess, buyers and sellers trusting each other. But there's a kind of philosophical bent to all of this. What's behind that, Sabrina?
I would say that this is the point where libertarians and anarchists meet. You've got that libertarian bent where people say, people should decide for themselves what they should or should not do, and government shouldn't stand in their way or dictate to them how they should go about their business. And then from the perspective of the anarchists, Silk Road represents the sort of lawless free-for-all where, again, government doesn't intervene and stand between you and what you want to do, whatever that may be.
Where do these products come from? Do you get any sense their origins on the site?
Yes, you can see on the site that it truly is a global operation. Sellers, when I went on the site, were claiming to be from the Netherlands, from England, from here in America, all over the world, and they appeared to be individual sellers. But there is a rumor that drug cartels are starting to dip a toe into the water and sell their drugs on there to try to get on this game. So when you're dealing with the sellers, you really don't know who you're buying from.
Well, do you see the Silk Road and other black market sites gaining popularity as most of the world goes online? I mean, is this where illegal business is going to take place?
I would say it was inevitable that the internet would be used as a black market. People were already using the internet to do all kinds of things with a certain feeling of anonymity. Well, now there's a software that promises true anonymity, and the gloves are off, and it makes the internet a true free-for-all for all the impulses that people have. So my guess is that, especially if law enforcement isn't successful in bringing down Silk Road, we'll be seeing more sites like this soon.
Well, Sabrina, thanks so much for that little illegal journey for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sabrina Erderly, a freelance journalist. She's written for magazines like Self and The New Yorker. She's also a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. You're going to find a link to her article, including that graphic I mentioned of the Silk Road interface. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And there's also a link to her website where you can read much more of her work there as well. And you have a legitimate seat for exchanging your ideas on the Word of Mouth radio page or on Facebook or on Twitter at Word of Mouth. Now, you won't find weapons-grade plutonium on Silk Road, nor will you find synthetic hearts yet. Completely artificial hearts are now available in the legitimate medical devices market, but they're only temporary and they're scarce. Elliot Majerzyk reports on these stopgap tickers that keep patients alive as they await heart transplants.
This is Dr. Vigneshwar Kesarajan, chairman of cardiac surgery at Virginia Commonwealth University.
We have nationally perhaps about 50 to 60,000 patients a year who would benefit from a heart transplant. We are able to do only 2,000 to 2,500 heart transplants.
While patients wait for a donor human heart, many of them need an artificial heart to keep them alive. Dr. Kasarajan and his team performed the first total artificial heart transplant on the East Coast.
Nationally, I believe currently we are the largest implanting center in the United States. But there are a number of centers that are starting to train and get proficient at it.
Until recently, patients with an artificial heart had to be tethered to a 350-pound machine. Dr. Kasarajan and his team are part of a national study on a new portable device that fits in a backpack and lets patients go home. That sound is music to the ears of patients who might have died from heart failure. It completely changes the quality of their lives.
Sometimes it's weird, like, because I feel so normal now. I just have these tubes coming out of my stomach. Other than that, I don't have any pain really or anything like that. I mean, sometimes I'll go to get out of bed and be like, oh, I need to grab this thing, you know. It just feels like I should just be able to just jump up and go.
The artificial heart is called a bridge to transplant. There's only so long the body can tolerate it.
At least in Europe, where the wait times for transplant can be considerably longer, there is experience with patients over 3 years on the artificial heart with good pump function. In our institution, we have had a patient with the total artificial heart for over 1 year waiting for a transplant. Beyond that, it's only our guesswork. We don't know, really.
Dr. Kasarajan says the survival rate for heart transplant patients has improved dramatically.
The median 10-year survival is about 60% now. So 60% of people are living at about 10 years after heart transplant. It's not just how long they live, but it's also the quality of life. After a transplant, if patients don't have major complications, which majority of them don't, the quality of life is very impressive at 10 years.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Elliot Majerczyk.
Coming up, art-based literacy opens up a new path for New Hampshire's immigration stories. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break. This is NHPR. Welcome back. The upcoming Thanksgiving holiday revives America's immigration story in classrooms across the country. The Mayflower Chronicle began the long narrative of huddled masses arriving on American shores that continues today. The experiences and characters have changed, as have the stakes in the debate over who is or should be an American. A recent project in two New Hampshire schools used art to help refugee and native-born children learn about how they got here and how much their stories have in common. Keith Shields brings us a story.
In my country, there are many mountains and towers over the plains.
This is Anurag Gimmery. He's 13 years old, lives in Manchester, and is in the sixth grade. He's also an author.
Every day in my country, I got up in early morning. We would bring water from tank.
Anurag was raised in a refugee camp in Nepal and came to New Hampshire in 2009. About a month after he arrived, he and many of his other immigrant and refugee classmates at Webster Elementary School in Manchester were given a great opportunity to write and illustrate their own book about their own lives, even though many of them, like Anurag, hardly spoke any English.
Like, first we painted the papers for pictures, and some other teachers helped me write a story. Like, I told them, and they write it, and they fixed the grammars and stuff.
The project was led by Beth Olshansky, who for the last 20 years has championed an idea in education called art-based literacy, where students learn reading through art, through drawing, painting, or collaging your story before you ever put pen to paper.
When I gave the children the option to either write their stories first, to paint pictures first, or to weave back and forth between the two, 22 out of 23 children chose to create their pictures first. So this was no longer about illustration because, of course, illustration has to do with illustrating an existing text. This had to do with what is the medium which children use to think and how do they develop their ideas and get them down on paper.
Olshansky traveled across the country teaching her art-based learning theory, but 2 years ago she got a grant to work with Manchester's growing immigrant and refugee population, having them tell their own stories while learning about the concepts of reading and writing at the same time.
My parents were born in Bhutan. They lived Bhutan because of the king, my mom.
I came from the children's home. It is for a lot of children who don't have any family.
I come from Syria, but in the beginning I was born in Iraq.
Students would first tell their stories. Then they would do the artwork, painting the colors of their landscape, cutting out the paper shapes of their mountains and homes, and then putting the difficult stories of their lives down on paper.
In my house, someone kicked in the window with a gun.
There is big fire in the camp. Flames were rising in the sky. It burned many, many, many houses. My sister is scared. She's crying.
Olshansky admits it wasn't easy. Students didn't want to talk about their hardest moments. But she started sharing her own story. She showed the class a picture she created of her immigrant relative. The relative looks very sad, and when she asked the class why she was sad, that's when the words began to flow for her students. And that's when Olshansky found the project became more than educational.
As I watched them, you know, there was a certain, I think, therapeutic component to the fact that they were now controlling the situation. They were no longer victims of this, but they actually got to create it, make it just the way they remember it. And then at the end, once they had recorded it, they got to close that book, that chapter in their life, literally, and choose to put it on the shelf, choose to take it off and look at it if they wanted or not. So the whole process became very therapeutic.
In 2010, Dennis Harrington, principal of Moheramit Elementary School in Madbury, visited Webster.
I was emotionally overwhelmed by what the children wrote. The story that impressed me the most was a little guy from Russia who was placed in a home in Russia and abandoned by his parents. And within a month, some Americans came over to adopt him.
They looked at me and my sister. They didn't like us. They don't take us. Then for 4 years, I wait.
And I wait 4 years. And then an another American family came and adopted me. And then he told the rest of his story, how he adjusted to living in the United States. And you see him on tape, and he's healthy, smiling, productive. And what hit me was strictly emotional and very hopeful.
Harrington had an idea to bring this project to Moheramit. The school is far different than Webster. There's hardly any foreign-born students, but Harrington still saw a learning moment. So along with Olshansky, a new crop of Webster students came down to Moheramit to work on writing their own stories together. It was at that point that many of the students at Moheramit began to learn that they too were sons and granddaughters and great-grandsons of immigrants themselves, and that these stories in many ways paralleled their new refugee friends. Beth Olshansky recalls one story after students were placed at tables by their ethnicity.
So in essence, she had created ethnic neighborhoods in her classroom. So all the Russian kids sat together, all the German, all the English. And as they were working, cutting and pasting their stories, they were chatting with each other about why did their great-grandfather or their great-great come. And they began discovering, gee, your ancestors came for the same reason that mine did. And then there began to be crosstalk among tables, so one ethnic neighborhood to another. And then when they got to meet the ELL students from Manchester, they learned, gee, not only were a lot of people having those same kind of problems way back when, but today those problems are still going on, and children today face many of those same challenges.
The books were presented last year to students from both schools, but the project continues. At Moheramit, teachers now read these stories in class, and it raises new discussions, not only about the issue of immigration, but their own personal immigration stories.
So you know what you're doing, all of you are doing, by thinking about Miriam and her story? You're showing empathy. Can you say that word?
Empathy.
Empathy.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Keith Shields.
You are imagining, what would it be like if I had to leave my...
Stay with us for the critical role of first responders in the fate of the mentally ill youth. That's when our Out of the Shadows series from WBEZ continues. Also, the many moods of permaculture. That's after the news from the BBC when Word of Mouth returns on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Iris.
You can feel like nervous and scared.
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. This week we've been exploring the issues surrounding mental illness in youth through stories of families, communities, caregivers, and the suffering kids themselves. Today, the Out of the Shadows series continues with WBEZ's Jennifer Brandel on the role first responders play in determining the futures of mentally ill and potentially violent teenagers and young adults.
Anna lives in one of those unassuming buildings peppered throughout Chicago that don't quite look like the homes and apartments surrounding them. These are assisted living facilities.
Give me that paw. Stop it. Oh, he's licking me.
Anna has been living here with her cat Snowball.
He's a Turkish Angora.
And a handful of other adults with mental illness for a few years.
I turned 21 on a Sunday, so that Friday I emancipated from DCFS. I had no guardian. I knew that I wasn't going to have any more help. I was scared when I was put in my own apartment because I thought that, you know, I was going to end up doing something really bad to myself.
Anna's diagnosis is borderline personality disorder, depression, chronic PTSD, and schizoaffective disorder. Since she was 13, she's bounced between dozens of hospitals and nursing homes. Anna has family in Chicago, but none she could turn to for help.
Unfortunately, my dad doesn't believe in mental illness, so it's kind of hard to talk to him. He doesn't believe I need medication. He has a thing about throwing my pills in the garbage, and I have to go scavenge hunting after them. It's hard to make him comprehend that I can't help it. He thinks I do it on purpose, so.
Anna says her dad didn't believe that her mom's mental illness was legitimate either. Her mom is schizophrenic.
Unfortunately, she jumped off a 7th-floor building and crushed her legs. She's permanently in a wheelchair bond. I just learned this last year, but my family kept that from me. Before that, I thought my mom was dead.
Her mother is now living in an assisted care facility in Texas. Anna arrived at her facility with the help of Thresholds. Her supplemental security income, or SSI, pays the rent. She's been doing well here, even holding down part-time jobs at Radio Shack and Target. But she wants more.
There's people here that's been here 10 years, 13 years, you know, and I don't want to be here the rest of my life, you know?
With our state in Illinois, we know that it's increasingly very seriously difficult to get any kind of mental health services if you don't have really good insurance or if you don't have Medicaid.
Mark Fagan is the Associate Director of Youth Programs at Thresholds. The nonprofit mental health agency provides treatment and housing. He says even though the law says adulthood starts at 18, insurance and Medicaid coverage don't necessarily follow that marker. So Fagan says that young adults experiencing a mental health condition,
they tend to not be able to qualify for those services at exactly the time where they need it the most.
Adding to that problem is the fact that the mental health care system is designed for independent adults or for dependent children. And there's not that much out there for those who fall in between.
At about age 30 is when young people actually become adults.
That's Vanessa Voorhees. She's a researcher who works with young adults at Thresholds.
You know, if we think about it, if you think of any other developmental phase across the lifespan, this one is what I find is most interesting is the amount of change. The young people tend to move a lot. They tend to be under a lot of stress because they have to pick college or a career or something, and you can become a parent. Also, young people are most likely to get or to develop serious mental health conditions during this time.
Because hormonal changes affect brain development, many disorders don't physiologically show up until these in-between ages. By the time these symptoms are identified, Fagan says,
the services that match with them don't follow along. And that's where we get into that, what we call a transition cliff.
Now, independence is hard.
Corey is 21 years old. He's been diagnosed with schizophrenia and lives with his family in Roscoe Village.
My family thought, you know, like it was just like a phase or a funk. It would like go away eventually. But unfortunately, it didn't happen and they decided I need professional help.
Corey is lucky to have parents who not only recognized his illness, but who still want him to keep living with them. Because many parents, after years of incredible difficulty raising a child with illness, are overwhelmed to the point of saying, you know what? You're 18. You're on your own.
One of my pills was $400. Another was $200.
While his family offers emotional support, he says they're not in a position to fully support him financially. Corey's monthly cost of medication comes to nearly $1,000. And like so many navigating insurance bureaucracy, he had a lapse in services.
We have Medicaid, and then they sent me a notice in the mail that at 19 they cut me off my insurance, but they never gave me a chance to apply for my own medical card. I didn't have insurance for a month and a half. I had to pay for my medications. I completely broke the bank. I had no money in my account whatsoever.
Shannon Garrison is a therapist working with Corey and many other young adults at C4 Chicago. She sees gaps in services like his all the time.
I'm still trying to figure out how this process works because there doesn't seem to be rhyme or reason, because I have quite a few clients that have the same mental health diagnosis, the same kind of delays or deficits in functioning, and one has gotten approved for a medical card and has gotten approved for SSI, but a kid in the similar situation can't get either one.
With this lack of medication and therapy, Garrison says young adults end up back in the hospital, or worse.
So it actually ends up costing more without these services, because you're going to see a lot higher rates in psychiatric institutions and in, unfortunately, the criminal justice system.
Garrison's program lost a $100,000 grant to fund their young adult services, and that's happening to programs like it across the state. They had been teaching scores of struggling youth everything from balancing a checkbook to job readiness. And it's dealing with some of that daily grind that makes life so hard for young adults like Corey.
When I'm stressed out, I get under pressure. I do have little breakdowns. I get angry. I cry. If I still went back to school, I'm afraid I couldn't finish, because to this day, I still crack down under pressure.
Both Corey and Anna have had it rough. But in a way, they're fortunate because they found help. Studies show that about 1 out of every 5 youth has a diagnosable mental health disorder. And of those, 70% never get treatment. Consider this. If 1 in 5 Chicago public school students had an undiagnosed mental disorder, there would be more than 57,000 ill children without mental health care in this city alone. Corey and Anna's lives illustrate just a few ways this transition age is treacherous. Despite advances in medicine and therapy, immense social stigma of mental health conditions remains immune to science. And considering everything, it's easy to feel hopeless. But Mark Fagan, who we heard from a little while back, says the very instability of this period is where there's actually hope, too.
Young adulthood is also a time where we're able to have some pretty serious influence in terms of both their biological structure as well as their social and emotional structure. So even though it's an incredibly difficult time, it also provides us with a lot of opportunity for hope and support and for the ability to create healthy transition along their lifetime.
What are your hopes for the future?
I want to become a social worker or a therapist. I want to become somebody that helps other people.
I don't want to throw my life away. I have dreams for myself.
Jennifer Brandel, WBEZ.
You can find a link to more on the Out of the Shadows series at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, it's not just organic, more than sustainable, it's permaculture. We'll travel to the base of the White Mountains to find out more. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth returns from NHPR. Welcome back. If agriculture is cultivating food, apiculture raising bees, and arboriculture growing trees, then what the heck is permaculture? NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown schlepped up to New Hampshire's frozen north to talk to people who practice permaculture and found that the term contains multitudes.
This is Dee Acres, a teaching farm in Dorchester, New Hampshire, spitting distance from the White Mountains.
So my name's Keith Morris.
My name is Steve Whitman.
And I'm here teaching the Permaculture Through the Seasons Permaculture Design Certification course.
Coming towards the end of the second permaculture design course to be run here.
I came to get an answer to a straightforward question. What is permaculture? But the soundbite wasn't forthcoming. Ask six people and you'll get six responses.
My name is Teresa. Permaculture, to me, is living in communion with your environment.
Obviously, there's many definitions of permaculture.
So permaculture, to me, is sustainable ecological design.
But in a nutshell, I would say it is integrating your life to become part of the natural system.
Permaculture is just that. It's simple.
At this class, the students, the teachers, everyone answers with dense, jargony boilerplate. But to break it down, it's about efficient buildings, waste management, saving and generating electricity, catching and using rainwater, and a whole hodgepodge of other topics. It's about smart, green systems that reduce the energy and resources that our lives require. But the best way to understand permaculture is to see it on the ground. Students at this weekend's class give us their favorite examples. First, here's Sarah Dunham.
Consciously thinking about my waste work, so I have worms, composting worms in my apartment. I try to make a lot of things by hand rather than buying them from somewhere. You know, if I can make it, I do.
And this is Jill Winton.
I would have to say the herb spiral is pretty cool. It's a mound of dirt to make a three-dimensional planting bed, and you can plant herbs that were like dry and hot near the top on the sunny side and plants that like cool and moist towards the back.
Permaculture is not just about agriculture. It's a school of design. And it's not just embracing trees and doing yoga in parks, though all that isn't incompatible with permaculture. Sometimes it can be about making money. Keith Morris talks about a test piece in class. It's a project in Milwaukee called Growing Power, which was started by former NBA player Will Allen. On a tiny 2-acre city plot, Growing Power is raising fish, bees, chickens, ducks, and goats, as well as growing sprouts, fresh greens, and herbs. There's a $250,000 worth of food in 2 acres of parking lot. And Morris says that when Allen got there, there was zero soil.
And they have a large and well-established composting operation where they're getting food residuals from all the restaurants and cafeterias and schools and supermarkets in the region, composting that.
In that urban waste dirt, the crew plants sprouts and greens that are grown dense, harvested fast, and sold for a pretty penny. The centerpiece of the operation are tanks of tilapia, flanking greenhouses. They sell them for $6 a fish, but also...
What happens when you keep a ton of fish in a tank, like wall to wall, gill to gill? Well, they foul the water, like almost immediately.
The fish manure water is pumped out of the fish tanks into vegetable beds. The veggies, incidentally...
By the end of the troughs, have it filtered, and it goes back to the fish in a constant recirculation.
It's permaculture. I asked Steve Whitman if permaculture is just common sense.
I think common sense is a huge aspect of this. Often we'll say at the beginning of a course that if some of this seems intuitive or like common sense, that's a good thing because you can't teach common sense, but there's a lack of common sense in a lot of decisions we make today.
Permaculture has been around for a while, but recently has started to wriggle into the mainstream. Gardens on roofs, food instead of lawns, green building and houses that gather and store heat from the sun without any PV panels or hot water tubes. That's all part of it, too. But really, permaculture is putting all of this together, and Whitman thinks that that's what's so hard to grasp.
I think people can wrap their heads around aspects of it. People can understand the value of organic agriculture, or they can understand the value of the local food movement, the local products, or things that seem tangible. To look at the big picture and see how all these pieces may or may not fit together is probably more than the average person is willing to dig into initially.
But you still can't find many people who know the word. The people who drove all the way up here this weekend, they don't much care. They, like permaculture, are solution-oriented, and so haven't stopped to consider how long it will take for the rest of us to catch on. But if someone seeing what they're up to says, hey, that makes sense, it'll be fine by them. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans-Brown.
it doesn't even give off any heat at all.
No, because it's so efficient.
One guiding principle for the budding permaculturist is diversity, as in maintaining genetic diversity in corn, potato, or apple crops. While the apple picking season was drawing to a close here in New England, Boise State Public Radio producer Guy Hand was jet boating through the Idaho wilderness to report on attempts to find and save from extinction orchards long ago abandoned by pioneers. We are at the end of the road.
That's Sadie Barrett, standing at a boat dock where road ends and wilderness begins, deep in the Salmon River Canyon of central Idaho. Barrett is on a mission.
We are getting ready to jet down to a historic orchard, and we're going to hopefully experience some wonderful food.
By wonderful food, she means apples. Barrett grew up in Salmon, Idaho. Moving back home after a 10-year absence, she noticed something was missing.
I used to glean fruit from a lot of the old fruit trees, and I noticed that a lot of them had disappeared. They'd either been built over or just had perished because they hadn't been irrigated.
That's why Barrett is blasting down the main fork of the Salmon River via jet boat to save threatened apple varieties. As we skip off rapids, Barrett points to one abandoned orchard after another. Pioneers planted many of those trees over 100 years ago in what is now the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness. As we jet by, we can see that many of those trees are dead or dying. After a 12-mile race into the wilderness, we pulled ashore at an orchard of 50 or more trees.
So where are we?
Lance Bar.
Barrett and friend Scott Grasser grab buckets, tools, and head toward a forest of apple trees planted by Frank Lance around 1925.
Nice little trail here.
We soon find a broken tree, its largest limbs snapped off like twigs.
Here's one that's obviously been
broken down by a bear.
Yeah, visited by a bear. It definitely needs some TLC. No fruit on it either.
There's fresh bear scat everywhere, and claw marks on nearly every trunk. But we soon find apples, plenty of apples.
Oh, look at this. Isn't that an interesting color?
Yeah.
Mmm. Woo. And all the flavors right up front. Super tart, super powerful. It's got a bite.
Barrett and project coordinator Candace Burns call their project the Idaho Heritage Tree Project. Today, Barrett is finding and carefully cataloging apple varieties worth saving.
Because we can't ID with gene testing, we just have to photograph, identify the trees, taste the apples, make notes of what the flavors are, decide if we want to graft that based on our own palates.
Then tag those trees and come back next spring to take cuttings and graft those cuttings onto new rootstock. Thus, Barrett and Burns hope to preserve some of the fruit tree diversity brought to Idaho by early settlers.
Mmm, that is one kind that we're looking for.
Oh my God.
Soon, we're finding apple varieties we'd never seen before.
Isn't that amazing?
Super sugary.
Yeah, that's a great apple.
Barrett and Grasser wander the orchard, meticulously tasting, tagging, and taking notes. On the way back to the jet boat, with a bucket of exceptional apples in hand, Barrett is already thinking about expanding the Idaho Heritage Tree Project.
Yeah, I think this is a fun spot to come and do the research, look around, see what's down here. But there are so many trees in people's backyards and in neighborhoods all over Idaho that are just as important as the trees down here, that hopefully we can capture at least a small percentage, get them going on new rootstocks so we can have them in backyards and
preserve them for the future.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to find out more about the Idaho Heritage Tree Project and how you could participate, go to salmonvalley.org for a link. For Edible Idaho and Boise State Public Radio, I'm Guy Hand.
Thank you for spending some time with Word of Mouth today. You can listen to segments from this program in our vast archive with a click of your mouse at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. You can also forward segments you like onto your friends. And we invite you to add your voice to the other Word of Mouth listeners on Facebook and on Twitter. Please join us again tomorrow at noon and again at 9 p.m. for more pioneering settlements on the vast plain of ideas on Word of Mouth. This is NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Virginia Prescott, Taylor Quimby, and Rebecca Lavoie. Oversight and support comes from Program Director Abby Goldstein and web support from Brady Carlson. We receive help from our online community of bloggers and contributors. Dan Colgan is our engineer. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. For more information about the show, to post a comment, or to listen to these interviews again and read our blog, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.